Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's August 28, 2012, and I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. We got a great show tonight for you. Thank you to GreatBrewers.com, our sponsor. Check out the Beer Cloud, a mobile app to help you locate your favorite beers. And also, we're supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 41 New York City beer bars. Check it out at GoodBeerSeal.com. Well, we have a special show for you tonight. Our long friend and early co-host, Sam Merritt from Civilization of Beer, is back. Yay. Back in New York. Welcome back, Jimmy. Sam.
Thanks a lot.
You know, there's always something so interesting about what you do. You had worked at Brooklyn Brewery for a long time, and you've been a beer educator and a consultant for many years. What new is coming up for you in fall with Civilization of Beer?
Well, Civilization of Beer turns 7 next month, and that's, to me, more important than the decade milestone, since we've done a decade's worth of work, I think, in 7 years with this thing. So we're expanding Civilization of Beer into other markets. We're going to have personnel in other markets. I've been doing the countryside here now for quite some time on my own, and having the kid now, being away from the family, is a little different. We're expanding our personnel out into the Northwest, and also a little bit further into the East, and it's going to be really great. So, yeah, we're just growing and growing as we usually do.
Well, there's a great schedule I have. You doing a class, regular classes you do at Institute of Culinary Education. You used to do a Cicerone 101 at Jimmy's Number 43. Mm-hmm. What is Cooking by the Book?
So it's a really nice private cooking space down in Tribeca. They fit about 25 people in for cooking classes, and they have beautiful ranges, and it's just a really nice setup in there. They started the business 25 years ago, just getting people together and cooking the same recipe, and it's grown quite a bit. They do a lot of corporate and private stuff, so we're doing a little season with them, some beer versus wine stuff, and some other really fun things, and we're culminating the season in a brewing class. We're going to be using our friends from Brooklyn Brew Shop's kits, and there'll be a bunch of us brewing right before the Super Bowl. So, you know, lots of good classes, lots of fun things we're doing.
So for fall, check out civilizationofbeer.com. There's a lot of great events going on. And Sam's quote is, an educated beer seller is a better beer seller.
Always.
So you work a lot with wholesalers too, don't you?
I do. I travel a lot to the, you know, there's about 2,000 wholesalers, so a lot of them are being very proactive. But yeah, you know, I find myself in
speaking of active
in you know, South Dakota in January, living the high life out there with them.
Well, that's an interesting angle for our show. We're also joined by Chris Kuzme, good friend, president of many homebrew groups, and part of Wandering Star Brewery. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you very
much.
It's
always good to have you on. Let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about wholesalers. So you're part of Wandering Star Brewing Company. And tell us about what you've gone through in that process. You have a wholesale distributor in New York.
Yeah, there's a three-tier system. We're not allowed to... Each state is allowed to make its own rules of whether breweries are allowed to self-distribute. In most states, breweries are allowed to self-distribute. But to cross state lines, you have to have a distributor. So it goes from the brewery to a distributor, then to the point of sale, to the retail. And for us, we signed pretty early on to get into New York City, and we have a great distributor, Union Beer Distributors, I think, who's also a sponsor of this show.
Yes, greatbrewers.com.
Yes, that's right. And it's been relatively easy because you have a distributor, but you still have to be out there on the ground as the brewer and have your own staff to really kind of push the brand itself and just market it and be there.
All right. Well, see, Sam, the reason I mentioned that is you said you're going to be working with, there's a wholesale conference coming up?
Yeah, the National Beer Wholesalers Association conference is holding it in San Diego in October. And so, you know, they all send people there, and that's a chance for them to work on their game a little bit, especially bringing on, you know, types of breweries that Chris has now, and you know, the 2,000 other breweries that are now on board. You know, they're still in the mode of change. You know, the craft beer movement is still being reacted to over the years with them. So it's nice. We're doing a nice seminar for them to talk to them about how they can get more involved in their communities as the breweries in their communities have, and step up and have an identity as far as, you know, these are the guys with the great beer list. And, oh, yeah, they also sponsor, you know, brewing contests and support, you know, local 501c3s and everything. But a lot of the time, the distributors haven't really had an identity. And so that's something that we're working on for them.
Great. All right. Well, what beer are we drinking? We want to talk a little more about the beers that we drink on the show, because we do drink a lot of beer on the show.
So this is the Ur Continent from Dogfish Head. And the idea behind this is that, you know, we all came from one continent, an original continent before the tectonic shift. And so this uses ingredients from all of the continents. And so Ur, you know, is original, Urkel, and things like this. You know, Ur is a very good, Urbach is a good prefix for beer and things, because it means original. So they're paying tribute to the fact that we were all, you know, on this one piece of rock at first, you know.
Do they have something from Antarctica?
You know, they usually write a lot about it, but here's the reason I got it, because I don't know anything that's in it. So that's why I got it, because I don't know what wattle seed is, amaranth, rooibos, Mirica, Gale, but I do know what honey is, and that's the last special. So it has those things and honey, and I think I might taste them all, but I don't know what they are.
What's the name of the beer again?
I've looked up wattle seed.
Oh, you have? Good.
I have. Amaranth is a grain.
Oh, there we go.
Wattle seed represents Australia. It's a term to describe the edible seeds from around 120 species of Australian acacia.
Acacia, which is a pretty interesting plant. If you chew on the flowers of that plant, your whole deal gets numb.
Wait, there's one more guy here,
too.
You
know where this is going.
Wait, Jackson Landers is here, too, and we're going to talk about his book, Eating Aliens. So there's four of us here. Jackson Landers, Sam Merritt, Chris Kuzman, and Jimmy Carboni. So we're going to talk a little bit. This beer is pretty awesome, actually.
Mm. It's real nice.
It's complicated. It's kind of Christmassy, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spicy.
Chris, what do you, as a, you're a home brewer and a brewer, when you taste beers, do you break them down in your head, or you just enjoy?
I believe there are two kinds of beers, you know, good kind and the other kind, and you know, you can tend to overthink stuff, so I try and definitely always maintain my just being a fan. But of course, as a brewer and as a home brewer, I can't help but try and break things down and think about it that way, because like, okay, if I wanted to recreate it, how could I do that? And not being familiar intimately with these spices is, you know, makes this beer an incredibly hard beer to try and think along those lines. Or trying to break down and say, if I were going to clone this, it seems like a challenging thing to do.
Yeah.
And Jackson, so you've been a home brewer. You're a lot of things. You're out there looking for species with the limit of their what do you call it? Turf? How do you describe what you
do? Well, what I've been doing for the last couple of years is hunting, butchering, and eating invasive species. That's for my new book, Eating Aliens, which launches the first week of October 2012. Although I've already started looking for just indigenous species at the farthest parts of their natural range. That may be my next book. You know, where is the farthest south moose? Where is the farthest north alligator?
The outliers.
You know, so find exactly, and what keeps them from going a little bit further? You know, and that involves going out into the field and looking for them. But right now, I've just wrapped up this project with hunting and fishing for invasive species all over the place. And the book mostly deals with things with parents, animals. But I did bump into a lot of invasive plants along the way also, including invasive Japanese hops, actually, which are pretty common in the American South. But for some reason, nobody's even trying to brew with them.
So tell us about, I mean, you're a home brewer.
I am. I've been home brewing since I was 17 years old, actually. I started home brewing. If I had walked home with a six pack of beer when I was in when I was 17 years old, I probably would have been in a whole lot of trouble. But somehow, when I came home with a copy of Charlie Papazian's book and a glass carboy and some malt and hops and so forth, this was okay. I think probably my parents figured the odds that, you know, he's gonna wind up with actual beer are pretty minimal. They probably thought, there's no way he's cooking so something. That, there's these smells. There's this malt or something.
It's a science project.
And that's how I treat it and I explain. Well, this is what I'm doing. And I would say, you know, ask my father, can you stir this for a few minutes? And we're gonna add this at this point of the boil. And this is what the yeast does. So they're kind of learning something. They're thinking this is interesting. They're still sort of doubting that this is gonna result in beer. And then it got to bottling, and I enlisted their help, you know, with getting everything bottled. And then when it was done, were they going to look at me and say, well, now you can't drink your beer after we watched you and helped you make it? And there it was. And somehow it was okay to drink this beer. But I think that probably made me a more responsible drinker as an adult, having that experience of where it was like, okay, this is something I really worked for and spent a lot of time on. I don't want to just, like, quaff it down and not think about how it tastes, you know, and drink irresponsibly.
So maybe we should
be better off that way.
High school kids should learn how to make their own beer if they want to drink it.
Absolutely. That's the moral of the story.
It's not illegal to buy homebrew equipment.
Every college quad should have a student-run brewery.
Mine did.
Sam, what's the next beer?
It's Omegang Bière de Hougoumont, I think is how you say it. It's a beer de garde, but it was aged on maple and oak wood staves. So I was interested to see kind of where the wood comes from with this.
Let's try this and see.
Yeah.
So, and Chris, I mean, you've homebrewed a lot. I know that. When did you first homebrew?
I first started homebrewing in 2001, and I've always wanted to live on the farm and be totally self-sufficient, but I brew and I'm involved in the beer world. I'm a musician first, and I'm never going to leave the big city because there's just not enough gigs out in the country, and I can't satisfy that need. But I've always wanted to be able to, you know, grow my own stuff and make my own stuff and totally live just in that thing. And so I moved to Philadelphia for a brief moment. I met George and Nancy from Home Sweet Homebrew and bought my first kit, and under their tutelage made my first homebrew. And I fell instantly in love with the process, and I became addicted to that. You know, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Yeah. That in between, you know, while you put it in the fermenter, and you can do is wait. You have nothing. You just you can't do anything for it. You've done your work. I mean, there's the saying
it's
that
it's a bun in the oven. It's like it's literally like birth when it happens, and it's good.
And you keep running out to like lift the little cloth or open the door and look at the fermenter and watch the little bubbles.
Oh, yeah.
Like that's going to tell you something. But you feel good watching it.
Transfixed.
Yeah. your job as a brewer is to make that yeast get a happy home.
It's like a million times
better.
Brewers
make wort and yeast make beer.
Yeah. And it's a million times better than watching clothes tumble in the dryer. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's pretty good. But
tastes better.
Maybe there's an attachment. You can do your clothes and make beer at the same time.
Yeah.
But so Chris and Jack, so with the last brew we had some interesting spices and ingredients. Have you made an interesting spice beer yourself?
I haven't. I'm not that
adventurous. Kind of controversial. When it comes to,
I don't like a lot of spiced beers, and I try not to use so much in my thing. I've gotten more into it now because my girlfriend Mary Izette is very into the weird and exotic and very into these spices. So I've, you know,
so what's another example? We had this wild one.
We made a rosemary brown ale for actually Haley and Steven's wedding recently, and that was really awesome, and it really was really nice. The rosemary danced with the phenolics of the Belgian brown. Sorry, it's a rosemary Belgian brown. So there was a bunch of yeast phenolics coming off, and that tended to dance really nicely with that rosemary, and that was really, really nice. It was in a balanced way. It wasn't loud.
Yeah, that's nice. At
what point do you add the rosemary?
We actually, for this, we put it in the fermenter, in the secondary fermenter, we put some rosemary sprigs, and we also put some rosemary sprigs in the last 5 minutes of the boil, maybe the last 2 minutes of the boil. But we didn't get enough rosemary, and Mary had actually made a rosemary extract or a tincture with vodka, and we threw that into the keg when we carbonated it.
Nice. And Jackson, any interesting spice beers you ever made?
I had a disaster with mugwort once, which I don't care to repeat. But now this doesn't.
What is mugwort?
Mugwort is a it's an herb that was used a lot for flavoring beer. I think more so back before hops became really dominant. Yeah. And it's, I think probably I used too much. The problem was I used it in place of hops. I used like 3 ounces of the stuff, and it was terrible. Of course, I was in college, so I drank it anyway.
Yeah.
But now I did have another experience, and this is, I don't know if you call this an adjunct or what, but not a spice exactly, but You know, we all know that Chardonnay is typically aged in oak barrels to give it that vanilla flavor, and it actually is vanillin, the chemical.
Or they put fake oak chips in and stir it around.
Yeah, once upon a time, they would do it in an actual oak cask, and it would leach the vanillin out. Well, some years ago, I had a massive oak tree in my backyard. Was pushed down by a sudden storm. It fell on my my house, destroyed the roof. It did about $25,000-$30,000 worth of damage. And the tree was being cut up, and naturally I thought, what can I do with this thing? You know, I took some of it and I built like some furniture and that sort of thing, but all these oak chips all over the place. I thought, these smell really nice. And I'm a real IPA fan. So I thought I wanted to make like a traditional oaky full-bodied IPA, and I took these red oak chips that were just real fresh from falling down on my house, and I put them in the fermenter, and it was just perfect oak flavor. It was delicious. It was like, you know, the lily from the puddle. It was something awful turned into something that tasted great.
Awesome. Hey, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes. We'll talk more about weird ingredients in your beer on Beer Sessions Radio. All right, cool. Okay, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. A special party is coming up September 9th, members-only party. You can go to heritageradionetwork.org. If you become a member, you get to come to the party, and there's going to be some really great chefs, Gramercy Tavern, Back 40 West, Del Posto, Momo Sushi, a lot of others. There's even champagne I saw. Perrier Jouet, I think, or someone like that. It's going to be a very cool party out at Roberta's in Brooklyn, and you should check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. On that note, you know, we've been on the air over about 2.5 years at Beer Sessions Radio. When we first started, Sam Merritt was one of our regular co-hosts. Since then, he's married and had a baby and moved upstate. So we got him in town today. But what's interesting is what Sam's done in the industry. You know, you started out working at Brooklyn Brewery in the old days, working with the Craft Brewers Guild, and you really know a lot of people in this industry. What do you think of what's going on in craft beer right now? Is it exciting for you? Is it interesting? Or are you just working hard?
Well, it's exciting, but I'm a little worried. You know, I think there's some narrow things going on with the creativity, and what I mean by that is, you know, and you're asking me, so I'm giving you my opinion. My opinion doesn't mean anything in this industry. I know how to train people about beer, but I don't really. I'm not one of those sounding off people, but there's too much IPA, bro. There's too much IPA. And there's going to be too many breweries if we don't take care of what happens with the small breweries. You know, 2,000 breweries now and 600 in planning is just an influx that it's like having triplets, you know, in a small house, and you didn't expect it. You know, until recently with the sonograms, people didn't even know they were going to have twins, you know, when they were going
and this I can is see like, having a baby has really influenced you. And when he talks about
everything to
if
it.
You know Sam, when he mentions birth or talks about these things, his voice almost breaks up, and I'm like, I want to cry, man.
Well, all right.
But listen, well, Chris, with Wandering Star Brewery, you're doing something different at Wandering Star Brewery. You're not really making IPAs.
No, actually, we have one IPA that Chris did, Kicking and Screaming, because as much as you say there's too many IPAs, it also is... It's still
required.
Very much in demand,
it's required,
and it is kind of required, it's almost like the footprint. You know, it's almost like the judgment of a brewery.
See, if you give an opinion, someone's going to disagree. That's what
I don't disagree with it. I like a good IPA, but I do think there is a plethora of IPAs, and it has made me more. When I go to a store, I don't go get IPAs anymore because I'm interested in other things, and I feel like, you know, okay, again, an IPA, not so much. And our IPA is more of an English style IPA. It's not the American slap you in the face
Thunderbolt IPA, kind of, right?
Thunderbolt IPA, but it's a hybrid. So we're using American hops, and you know, it's got a malt backbone of an English pale ale, and then we're heavily hopping it.
Tell us about the summer beer, the USSR. Well, that beer was pretty cool.
We really like it. The USSR is, we call it the, it's the ultimate summer session rye is the acronym, what that all stands for. And instead of, like, instead of using rye as a base malt, we used rye crystal malt. So we got a beautiful reddish hue of it. It's 4.4% alcohol, so it's summer sessionable light, although dark, little dark and red in color, but really light body. And but it gets the spice. It gets a rye spice and breadiness from crystal malt and not from, from base malt. So you get the flavor of the rye without having a really gooky mash that, you know, we didn't get a stuck mash. You know, it prevented us from any of that.
You mean when you're saying the actual rye itself
has a really sticky sugar kind of thing. So when you're mashing with rye as
it's
a base
similar
malt.
Similar to what wheat does.
Yeah, similar to wheat, absolutely.
Harder to filter out.
So you can't, can you make 100% rye beer?
Absolutely.
You can.
Well,
good. It's hard.
It's not going to be easy.
It's not going to be easy.
The gauntlet has been thrown.
And yeah,
one can. You may or may not.
It might not even be that great. But it's a
all right. And another beer you want to tell us about?
Well, we're speaking of rye, so we're taking it, and we really liked what it did in the summer. But we're going to do an October, our version of Oktoberfest, and we're calling it you know, Red October, and it's basically going to be our USSR on steroids. So the USSR is a summer session beer, 4.4. The Red October is going to be probably 6.5, and I think we are going to lager it. We're going to use pretty much
so it's still going to be rye based.
Yep, it's going to be a rye Oktoberfest.
So what's different? How you make it from go from 4.4% to 6.5%?
We're going to use more malt to get more fermentable sugars. It's going to be a thicker beer, bigger in body. We're still going to use rye crystal malt in the same way that we did with the USSR.
So I don't understand. So using just rye versus rye crystal malt, what's the difference? Like even when you buy it, does it look different?
So a base malt is a malt that has been kilned at a lower temperature for a decent amount of time to stop all the growth of the starches.
And dried.
Dried, yeah. But if you kiln barley at higher temperatures, you'll get less fermentable sugars, but you'll get body and residual sugars.
Unfermentable sugars, maltodextrins, which give they don't have a flavor, but they are sugars, and they give the beer this sort of bigger body, which gives you a sweetness perception, too.
And then why does it call it crystal malt? What makes it crystal malt instead of malt? Is that what you just said?
It mashes a bit inside the husk, I believe, when it's roasted. So there's still a lot more moisture to it when it's heated, and it converts some sugars that the yeast can't get to.
Okay.
It does. Yes.
I love this show because I love when I'm stumped, and I appreciate it. Yeah. So the beer we were just drinking was the Hougoumont from Omegang.
Oh, yeah.
Who wants to tell us about this beer? Because this is pretty interesting. We had it at the Belgian Comes at Cooperstown Festival.
The Vaillamia.
Just go back to the one we had before that. Omegang, the Hougoumont beer.
Yeah, the Hougoumont. So Beer de Garde, you know, it's really, it's very spritzy. Usually those Beer de Gardes on the French side get a little bit more malty and soft, but this one's pretty sort of... you know, jumping over the border a little bit to the Belgian Saison. But I get a little bit of the wood in it.
Did you like the Hougoumont, Jackson?
I like it. It's aggressive in a kind of Belgian way. Is this Cara Munich malt? What am I tasting here malt-wise?
Yeah, it seems like. Yeah. Which is like, you know, a caramel, you know, sort of a bready, sweet.
Sam, I mean, you're really an expert taster, and, you know, you're a big guy in Cicerone program. I mean, can you just taste malts, different malts, when you're drinking beer?
Yeah, and hops, you know. But the tasting is, you know, it's pretty technical, you know. It's like it's important to be able to nail those. But it's only, you know, a third of those master tests. The rest is, you know, knowing the other stuff. So it gets difficult. But, you know, if you're trying to show off for your friends and you know, they make a homebrew and they bring it over and you say, oh, you use this, you know, hop in it, you know, big deal, you know. So I can smell a hop. I smell it a bunch of times, you know.
Right.
So
I have a question. I have a vocabulary question, and it came up in conversation mm-hmm. recently. What do you think about the word dank as a descriptor?
Oh, I saw that. Beer descriptor. Well, I had a cousin from out west, and they had come out east, and my wife made a giant thing of ziti, because that's what they do from Long Island when there's a bunch of family around. So
you mean pasta?
Yeah. So they all sorry. So they all eat this thing for 4 days, and I could tell they all loved it. Kept reheating it, all this, and so she puts on Facebook, "Oh, that pasta was so dank," you know, and I got all mad because I thought dank was like a musty, you know, basement cellar like thing, which is not how I would describe my wife's pasta at all. You know, so dank, you know, I think it's an herb term, and I mean yeah. marijuana. So if you have very dank marijuana, you know, it's very pungent, and it's gonna be still giving off its essential oils by oxidation and giving you all those essential oils, so it's gonna smell. And I think dank, you know, especially when it comes to the marijuana and the hop connection, you're going to get those oily, pungent smells off of the wetter hops as well.
It makes sense. The two plants are, skunky. I mean, for anyone who doesn't know, those two plants are very closely related. They're both in the Cannabisae family, yeah. both hops and cannabis sativa. So, yeah, I mean, as a descriptive term for, you know, like really heady hops, to have that in a beer, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I think that's a useful part of the beer vocabulary.
I agree here, but I mean in the conversation that I had, it was at a dinner table, and it was stemmed from the what you yeah. you know came from that, but you know half of the crowd still related it to being a dark, dingy basement and didn't make that connection. So to have it be a valid, I mean, I think that, you know, I brought it up because we were talking about you and you know, and tasting and being able to pinpoint and nail yeah. things is an important thing. But I think that having a beer vocabulary and some sort of standardization in that way is important. And this is one of those areas where it means different things to different people. But I think it's totally valid on both sides. Yeah. So you can't just use the word dank. You'd have to say dank like a basement or dank like yeah. like,
or
good,
yeah. like you know, the, like yeah. a forest floor after the rain. Mm-hmm. You know, there's about, I just read a thing in NPR how there's about 18 different smells that are related to what happens when it rains, before the rain, after yeah. the rain, when things are drying out, or if it's sunny and it stopped raining, or, you know, all of the above. And, you know, some of it's wet earth, some of it's, you know, all kinds of things growing right away. And as a hunter and an outdoors person, you know that there's so many different relationships to just that one thing, rain.
Oh, yeah.
It's similar, yeah. you know, and so dank can mean, you know, a great smell to somebody.
I'll tell you what, we just went from dank to bright to the yeah. the next beer is what?
So the Via Emilia transition, right?
So the Via Emilia from Italy here, they say, well, it won the World Beer Cup for Keller beer, which is, you know, a rustic style
of a little
lager.
Brighter lager. Yeah.
And it's very dry, and it's very hoppy. It's very similar to sort of Pilsner.
There's still a little breadiness to it, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what do you think, Jackson? Before we sign off, what do you think of this?
Well, this beer, I'm thinking, you know, the taste reminds me of like freshly cut hay.
Yeah.
You know, hay and straw. It's mm-hmm. That's what I'm getting here. It's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a number of really great small breweries in Italy, and our friends at Be United import them. This is one of them, Via Emilia. So, hey, let's take another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
It's a good little palate cleanser.
Stitcher? Heritage Radio Network is on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal, and we're here in studio with Jackson Landers, the author of Eating Aliens, Sam Merritt from Civilization and Beer, and Chris Kuzme from Wandering Star. So, Jackson, let's talk about your book a little bit, Eating Aliens. Before today, you had talked about bringing in an invasive Japanese hop that you were going to make a homebrew with. You didn't get to do that.
They weren't ready yet.
So tell us about that. Tell us about the hop and things that we might find in this part of the country that we could possibly brew beer with.
Yeah, there's a variety of hops, Humulus japonica, I believe, that was brought to the U.S. It was actually primarily for erosion control. They thought they could plant it by the side of the road and it would do really good at holding hillsides back. And it kind of went crazy. And you will find this stuff by a lot of rivers, actually. You'll find it right by the water, usually. And it'll usually be sort of a monoculture where it's just growing all over the place and there's nothing much coming up in the middle of it. And it's been dismissed in the past as useless for brewing. But it's been a long time since I can tell that anyone actually tried doing anything with it. It does not have significant amounts of alpha or beta acids, so it's not going to be a good bittering hop. But you know, I've picked this stuff and I've made tea with it and I've done other things with it, and it has a really nice aroma. I think it's definitely got potential as as an aromatic and flavor and finishing hop. You know, something as a home brewer that I would put in the last 10 or 8 minutes of the boil or so. I think it's definitely got potential, and it's one of these things where when you look it up on the internet, it just says there's no utility in brewing, but there's no reference to, hey, who tried it? You know, and I found that a lot when I was working on my book, Eating Aliens. I found all kinds of species that, of fish that American fishermen say, well, you can't eat carp. Oh, they're inedible. You know, they're too bony. They're too tough. They taste foul. And I went and, you know, killed some and ate it, and it was really good. Tasted like cod. It was great. You know, I find that a lot. When you have common wisdom that says something in the wild isn't worth eating, but you can't find anyone who's actually done it, you know, maybe it's time to go and try and do something with that.
Well, a lot of people,
I think it's come that time with hops.
A lot of people that make something that you could eat or drink say that what they make and is good, and then you assume that everything else is bad. And
maybe it's just different.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me about Chinese mystery snails, your final chapter?
Oh, yeah. These guys are, they use them a lot in koi ponds.
Can I get some?
Yeah. I'll bring them up.
No, I'm cutting it. Stop. Go back to beer. We're talking about, okay, so these invasive Japanese hops, would they grow around here in the New York region, or are they more in the south?
Yeah, there are more of them in the south, but you will find them. There are. I couldn't point you to a specific place to go right here, and I wouldn't do it on the radio anyway, because you're going to have 200 people in one spot. But you will find them growing by water. I would encourage you to go up and Google what hops look like, and if you walk around,
they look like other hops.
Yeah, exactly.
They have a similar,
yeah,
hop similar experience. Species.
Yeah, the flowers are shaped a little bit differently. The leaves look pretty much the same. And I've grown hops myself. Also, I've grown a couple different varieties of hops, conventional hops, and they do look a lot alike. The cones are a little bit different. The cones, each individual flower is definitely smaller, and they don't have the same visible orange or yellow glands on them. They do have some of the glands, but they're very small. And I think there's potential as a finishing hop there. I think homebrewers need to start experimenting with them.
We had on one time we talked to the Fisher brothers, who they have a great book, The Homebrewer's Garden, and they talked about using everything from dandelions to other home garden ingredients in place of hops or in addition to. Chris, have you worked with any other unusual finishing hops or other herbs or spices?
In place of hops, I have not. I mean, there's the tradition of using chamomile in addition to or fully replacing coriander and Belgian wits, and I've done that with great success, especially using spalts or a good German hop, actually, in those, and that I've had a lot of really great wits come out of that. Outside of that, I've not made a spiced beer. Like I said, I've never been that into spiced things until now. Recently, Mary and I did make a mead where we used some pepper. We used strawberry and black peppercorn, which was awesome. Wow. And the way the strawberry danced with the peppers, I mean, I really enjoyed that. And I would like to incorporate that into a beer. I just haven't figured out what sort of base beer just yet. I was thinking strawberry pepperweizen.
Just not an IPA, right?
I love it. That's great. Yeah, and going back to sort of that comment about, everybody's got an IPA and everything, you can balance sweet with sour, and you can, strawberry rhubarb pie is a perfect, tart and sweet thing. And so getting into more of the as we say, non-traditional. The hops only been around, you know, 1,000 years or so. But getting back to the real traditional ingredients, you know, is kind of a really, that's to me and a very exciting side of it, is to say, well, you know, if it's growing around where you live, then that's what people were using to flavor whatever they were eating or drinking.
Yeah, historically.
And so that's kind of neat. It's like, oh, okay, well, it's that time of year again. So let's go get it.
Cool. What do you think of this beer? So this is the Wandering Star Mild at Heart, which I like a lot.
Well, I could talk about it all day.
Yeah, tell us.
Well, you're the guy.
So, I think, what is it? It's like a roasty, earlier today it's a dark beer.
It's a 4.4% English dark mild. So it's on the far extreme dark side of the mild. So I mean, you know, it's not quite open. Sometimes opaque. It's opaque right now at the moment. But it's roasty.
I'll get a refill.
It's
like a
real chocolate notes on the sides of my tongue, on the edge of the palate.
Yeah. But it's really light in alcohol. Light it chocolate. Has the flavors of a you know, imperial stout if you wanted to go there, but without the alcohol content. I think that it's extreme flavor without extreme alcohol. And I think you were talking about how we do things a little different over here. I think this is our defining beer, and this is kind of what identifies us. I mean, I'm the most proud of this beer in particular.
It's quite understated.
It's like an imperial stout without the imperial.
And remember when Kelso first started, they made their chocolate lager. It's a similar thing, right? Whether it's a darker malt. It's still sessionable.
We have a lot of chocolate malt in this, some roasted barley, and sessionable.
I could 4. Drink 4. A couple 4%. Pints of this.
Yeah, and it's amazing with barbecue. It really it really dances with the Milanoids.
You know, I'm a big fan of like dark beers in summer. I really think that there's a lot of great, you know, dunkel lagers. There's so many styles that to me have dark color but are refreshing and go well with food. Sam, any styles or particular beers that come to mind?
Well, you know, the black lagers, the Schwarz beers are great. You know, and a nice cold, black lager seems to do wonders. And so, you know, I think the main thing that palate-wise that I avoid is big sweetness, you know, in the summer and tend towards more acidity. And most of the darker beers are going to give you acidity, not through the hop, but through their roast, and that's a nice thing. And so if you can get past, drink a hot cup of coffee on the beach, you know, it's not the same thing. It's you can chill it down and everything and drink it in the dark, and we're just doing fine with it here.
Chris, I really do like this one a lot.
Thank you very much.
Wandering Star.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Very proud of it. Yeah. We really love it.
A little bit of coffee
in
the aftertaste, actually.
Yeah.
A little coffee in there.
Yeah. It has all those elements.
So it's amazing.
But it's a dark mild, and mild is such a wide, wide category. Yeah. I mean, dark milds and light milds.
They're not overly anything. It's hard to nail something that's not overly anything. You have to fit all these different things in subtly, and that's what that does. And so it's like that middle sip of, you know, your iced coffee during a hot day. You know, it's like, oh, okay, it's refreshing me. It's doing all kinds of things, but it's not knocking me over the head.
So what is it, the process of making this flavor is really coming from the malt. It's like I used to make a lot of gumbo. You'd start with the roux. It's just the flour and the fat, and a little more color you gave it, if you did it right, there was a lot more flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with malts, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you guys buy these where do you buy your malts?
We use all mostly English malts, all English malts, Maris Otter, and we get them all from, not Bryce, Muntin's.
To malt guys.
I don't remember.
So there's guys selling malts.
The maltsters make the malt. The brewsters make the brew.
Yeah, exactly.
The maltsters make the malt. That's why I like talking to homebrewers, and I like talking about like local ingredients, because I know that, you know, there's these ingredients for beer. You get water, you get your malt, your hops, and other things. But it's cool to supplement it with things that can be grown locally, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Jackson, anything else besides the invasive Japanese hops that you would make a beer with that you've seen in your, you know? What are you doing? You're not a forager. You're like a wilder or something.
I think he's like a some sort of assassin. But he's like an eradicator, but he eats them. So he's like almost like Godzilla or something.
One time we did a demo at Jimmy's number 43. You told people how to hunt and clean and
I teach
deer.
So
what, you know, you're hunting venison. What kind of beer would you drink?
Oh, with venison, I like something. I usually want something kind of dark with a lot of body to it. You know, with venison, it's a rich red meat. It's like beef with less fat and more flavor in it. Actually, you know what would pair well with
it's less sweet, isn't it? Than
It's less of the beef flavor. Okay. Venison can be kind of sweet, actually.
Right.
It depends on what it's been eating. Especially if you get deer that have been gorging on an apple orchard for a little while, they're going to be more sweeter. Actually, this last beer that we're tasting, the dark session ale,
the mild at heart.
Yeah, the mild at heart. That would do very. I think that would pair very well with venison.
I was thinking that too. Sam, any other suggestions for pairing with venison?
We always have to ask how it's prepared, you know, and what you put on it, because that's, you know, you can really manipulate food. So
let's say we're just talking venison medallions from a backstrap that have just been pan-seared with a little bit of, thyme and butter, served very simply, rare, without a whole lot of other flavors cluttering it up.
I would say, either Vienna lager or maybe just a regular Bock. Mm. For some reason, for my palate, I've always gotten sort of a less fat with the venison, so therefore less sweetness for my experience. So I'm like, I want to add sweetness to venison. I've always had onions with venison.
Yeah.
When I just cook it up, and it seems like I'm doing that because I want that sweetness,
the caramelized,
that sugariness. So that's where I would crave
a lot of gamey meats.
Well, venison only tastes gamey if it was butchered sloppily. I mean, if you handled beef the way that a lot of people handle venison, it would taste gamey too. Game, you think of all different species, people say taste gamey. Wild goose is gamey, rabbit is gamey, wild turkey is gamey. The only thing that these different species have in common is sloppy DIY butchering. Across the evolutionary spectrum there, and when it's handled very quickly,
you're saying that my friend with the 100 pounds of deer in his freezer, you don't really want to cook that unless you know how they.
Well,
cut
he maybe your friend did a good job with it.
Well, that's a big part of how it's going to taste.
You want that deer butchered quickly and cooled down and processed fast.
On the note of cooking, a really good chef I see on the cover of your book, Eating Aliens. Our friend Matthew Weingarten, his executive chef at Insides Park at St. Bart's, he has a quote on the cover, and this guy is an awesome outdoor cook. He's done a lot of overnight pig roasts. Really respect him. He says, "Grab your shotgun and your frying pan, and let eating aliens be your guide to becoming the ultimate invasivore."
Yeah, I did a dinner. Matthew and I actually we did a dinner together a couple months ago. Actually, here in Manhattan, where I brought a bunch of stuff up, some Chinese mystery snails up that I had picked up, and we got some. We got some wild pig, and we got some snakehead fish, and a bunch of other stuff, and some lionfish. And we did a press dinner together because he's got a book actually coming out about preserving wild foods. And so we did this thing together. We cooked together. He's a fantastic chef. His food's great. His book's great. Real good guy, Matthew.
Awesome. We love him. Okay, last thing. So hunting wild pigs.
Yeah.
What do you do? How do you do it?
How do I do it? The way that I do it isn't necessarily the way that anyone else should do it. As I talk about in the book, I've hunted them a lot of different ways, usually based on restrictions someone else has put on me. The craziest way I've ever had to hunt them was I was in Texas for a while, and I had a week or so where the only way that I had to hunt them was said, "You can hunt them, but we don't want you discharging a firearm." And I didn't have a bow, so I was chasing them on foot with a knife, actually.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that was a little different.
And then what do you drink with? What's the last beer that you just poured, Chris?
Brasserie Du Du Ciel from Montreal. Corne du Diable. Corne du Diable.
Another beer.
That's a
American-style IPA.
It's like, to me, this is like a reddish, dark IPA.
Yeah.
Nice.
But this would go well with the pig, I think, the wild pig.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a favorite pairing for wild pig, freshly killed?
Oh boy, pork is so flexible. It is. Fresh pork, I usually want something. A pale ale actually would be really good. A real simple pale ale, not an IPA, but a pale ale that's going to get along with it, or like a British session ale is going to get. It's usually pretty light meat, depending on. With wild pig though, you're going to get a lot more variation in flavor than you do with commercially bought pig.
Because it depends on where they are and how much fat is on them.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, and what they've been eating. Wild pig that you get in the autumn, and if you get a pig in November or so, when they've been eating acorns for the last month or so, you know, that's going to be like Iberian ham, and Iberian ham is world famous. And part of what gives it that flavor is they're actually they're allowed to run pretty much sort of wild over very large spaces, and they're finished on acorns, and that's what gives a world famous Iberian ham its flavor. And then also the way that they handle it, of course. But so if you get a wild pig in the fall after it's engorging on acorns, it's going to be a lot like Iberian ham. On the other hand, if you take a pig that's been, you know, disrupting things going on in an orchard for the last month, it's going to have those apples that are influencing the flavor. So you've got a lot of regional variation in the flavor of wild pork that you just don't find anything like that in commercial pork.
Wow. Well, that brings us to some events coming up. We've got this weekend, it's Pig Island, pigisland.com. Tickets are almost sold out, but we're very proud to be producing that again for the third year. And there's pigs from 5 different local farmers and 25 chefs. Also coming up September 8th at the Rockaways, it's Beer Sessions Radio with Edible Queens and the guys from Roberta's. It's Barrels and Kegs at Rockaway Beach. Go to goodbeerseal.com. There's over 20 breweries, including Wandering Star, Greenport Harbor, Six Point, and Barrier Brewing in the newest Rockaway Brewing. September 9th, again, check it out, Heritage Radio Network. Become a member and come to our party September 9th at heritageradionetwork.org. And market calendars also. Village Voice, this is the fall preview issue, so there's a lot of events coming up. The Village Voice's second annual Brooklyn Poor event, October 6th. So go to goodbrewseal.com for more information. This has been a really great show. Jackson Landers, were buddies a few years ago. He did a slow food dinner. Told you how to hunt and clean and cook venison. Sam Merritt back in New York. He's got a baby, and Civilization Beer has some great events going on if you want to learn about beer. Chris Kuzme, more than ever, he's running homebrew events and working with Wandering Star Brewery. So all these great people here on Beer Sessions. I love you guys. I'll make
thanks,
a toast
Jimmy,
on air.
Cheers. Cheers.
That's all right. Cheers. So thanks to our brewer. Gosh, we're back. We spent most of the summer at Ombegang Brewery. Belgian comes to Coopastown, it seems like. We did a couple shows up there, and we're back. And you know what? It's a great place to go. Cooperstown is a beautiful town. It's great to go in the summer. And we'll be back there next year. And you should join us every summer up there. BCTC, they call it. Isn't that cool? The acronyms BCTC, GABF, all this fun stuff.
All these USSR.
Yeah, I don't want to get off the air, man. This is the best show ever. You know, and what was the last brew we had?
Corne du Diable. That's
the CCTDBBD.
Corne du Diable.
Hey, and try this too. If you're doing Twitter, it's awesome. At beer underscore sessions. All right, so thanks to our sponsors, greatbrewers.com. Thank you so much, and we really love you guys. And we'll be signing off. Thanks to everybody. Joe and Aaron and Bree, our producer, and Jack Inslee. And thanks again to Jackson, Sam, Chris for joining me here. Jimmy Carbone, Beer Sessions Radio.
Cheers.
All right.
Cheers.
Cheers.
This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
My wife often frowns when we're out on the town, and I'm wearing a suit and a tie. She's sipping vermouth.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org is the most trusted media outlet for real, quality conversations about food. That experience will come to life at our first annual members-only fundraiser party on September 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Enjoy the best food in the world from talent including Michael Anthony, award-winning chef from Gramercy Tavern, Brooks Headley, award-winning pastry chef from Del Posto, Shauna Pacifico at Back 40 West, sustainable seafood from Sea to Table, and much more, including drinks made by Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues, craft beer from Greenpoint Harbor Brewery, wine from Cane Vineyard and Winery in the Napa Valley, and plenty more. Radio is back, and this will be a special, exclusive experience in the back garden of Roberta's that you don't want to miss. September 9th, 5 to 8 p.m. Buy tickets at heritageradionetwork.eventbrite.com.